You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
I am with Lionel Burney, and in our Berlin satellite office of the Cycling Podcast, Daniel Freib.
Hello, chaps. How's it going?
It's going okay. We had a bit of a break since the Vuelta, haven't we? Is that only 2 weeks ago?
Yeah.
Wow. There is. A lot's happened.
Yeah. It certainly has. The Eneco Tour has been brilliant.
Yeah, let's talk about the Eneco Tour. We might talk about the Eneco Tour at some point, but before we get on to the big subject, which I don't think people probably need reminding of, but it's the controversy surrounding the one of the athletes' data leaked by the Fancy Bears, the group of, we think, Russian hackers who hacked into the WADA's ADAMS system, and they've released a whole tranche of athletes' information about TUEs. One of the athletes concerned, of course, was Sir Bradley Wiggins, the 2012 Tour de France winner. And while most of the TUEs haven't raised too many questions or red flags, Wiggins have, and they've been hotly debated over the last, well, as we speak, 11 days. Took 10 days for Wiggins himself to address some of the questions in person, and we're speaking the day after Sir Dave Brailsford also spoke about it. So we'll talk about that in a moment, but first of all, let's have a news roundup. Lionel.
Thanks, Rich. There's been plenty of racing since the Vuelta finished. Notably, Peter Sagan won the European Championship road race in Plumelec in Brittany. This is the first time men's elite riders have taken part in these championships, and the race attracted a pretty strong field. It was due to be held in Nice, but the championships were moved following the terrorist attack there in July. Anyway, Sagan outsprinted Julian Alaphilippe of France, Daniel Moreno of Spain, and Samuel Dumoulin, also of France, to give Slovakia the European title. And it means that Sagan, for a couple of weeks at least, is European and world champion. Dutch woman Anna van der Breggen won the women's road race to add the title to the Olympic gold medal she won in August. She beat Katarina Nieuwendamme and Elisa Longoborghini. They took the silver and bronze medals. It also completed a Dutch double after Ellen van Dijk won the time trial, also ahead of van der Breggen. Jonathan Castroviejo of Spain won the men's time trial, having narrowly missed out on a Vuelta stage win to Chris Froome a few weeks ago. The big race has been the Eneco Tour, the final stage race of the World Tour calendar, and it was won by Nicky Terpstra after a dramatic final stage that finished on the famous Moor in Gerardsbergen. Rowan Dennis of Australia, who'd won the individual time trial and whose BMC team had clinched another team time trial win, led overall going into the last day, but he crashed and eventually abandoned the race. Peter Sagan, who won two stages, looked well-placed to win overall, but a group of Terpstra, Olivia Nason of IM Cycling, and the eventual stage winner, Edvald Bosenhagen of Dimension Data, got away, and that handed the Etix Quickstep rider Terpstra a well-earned overall victory. There's been loads of racing in Italy, as there always is at this time of year, as they gear up to the World Championships, and with Il Lombardia on Saturday, of course. Sonny Colbrelli, who will ride for the Bahrain Merida team next year, has been in great form, winning the Coppa Agostoni, the Coppa Sabatini and the Tre Valli Varesina one-day races. His Bardiani teammate Nicola Ruffoni also won the Grand Prix Bruno Beghelli. Orica Bike Exchange's Esteban Chavez won the Giro dell'Emilia, and Daniele Bennati won the two-day Giro del Toscana, where Giovanni Visconti and Sam Bennett were the stage winners. So plenty of racing going on, but another sprinter who's in form with the Worlds coming up is Colombia's Fernando Gaviria, who won the Classic Impanis in Belgium. So a little bit of transfer news to finish up with. Taylor Finney is joining Cannondale Drapac next season, as Richard Moore mentioned on the podcast a few weeks ago. Ben Swift will leave Sky to join Lampre, although the team won't be called Lampre because following a Chinese takeover, they'll be renamed, rebranded. Also joining Swift there will be BMC's Darwin Atapuma. And the 37-year-old Spaniard Joaquim Rodriguez, who retired after the Olympics, is reportedly rethinking that decision and has been linked to the Bahrain Merida team. No doubt they would find his World Tour points very valuable. Finally, it's been confirmed that the bank HSBC will replace Sky as headline sponsor of British Cycling.
Thank you for that, Lionel. As I mentioned beforehand, the big topic and the one that will, I suppose, dominate this week's podcast, our returning weekly podcast, is Bradley Wiggins and his TUEs. Can you just maybe give us a little bit of background to this?
It's a very complex developing story, isn't it? But the headlines are that the Fancy Bears group, which we believe are a Russian group who have hacked into WADA's computer systems and accessed the ADAMS, which is the anti-doping record-keeping network, we believe, although this is supposition, we believe in retaliation for the sanctions that were placed on Russian athletes in the run-up to the Olympic Games, but it's clearly a huge data leak. And the headline riders are Chris Froome, Laura Trott, Callum Skinner, Steve Cummings was also named, Fabian Cancellara was also named. But the rider that has attracted by far the most attention is Bradley Wiggins, winner of the 2012 Tour de France. And it has emerged that he had therapeutic use exemptions which permitted him to use an otherwise banned corticosteroid called triamcinolone before the 2011 Tour de France, 2012 Tour de France, and 2013 Giro d'Italia. And the background to this is that Team Sky was established at the end of 2009, ready for the 2010 season, with a very strong zero tolerance towards doping policy. Their statement, or Sir Dave Brailsford's statement, was that they would have no association with doping. And so this has created serious controversy and has raised questions for Sir Bradley Wiggins and Sir Dave Brailsford, which have only partly been answered at this stage, I would say. We should make clear, though, Richard, that no rules were broken and that the therapeutic use exemption was applied for and granted in accordance with the UCI and WADA regulations. Nevertheless, it has caused real controversy in the past 10 days.
And Lionel, worth mentioning as well, you talked about the sort of founding principle of Team Sky. Their mission statement, really, one of their mission statements, was to find a clean winner, a clean British winner of the Tour de France within 5 years, wasn't it?
It was indeed, and from their point of view, they would say that they achieved that in 2012 when Wiggins won the Tour. But this case really sheds light on what is performance enhancing, and in fact, what is clean sport. The TUE system exists for very valid reasons, and that is to allow athletes who are unwell to take medication which normal people would otherwise be able to take without any consequences. But of course, a strong corticosteroid like this, it strays, I would say, into the grey areas, and it does create a lot of questions, which we will discuss now, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, there is an argument that an elite athlete's job, if you like, is to go up to the line of what is legal and what isn't legal. Unfortunately, in modern sport and in our sort of medicalised world, that means a lot of sort of raises a lot of ethical questions and puts the athlete in a position where they have to make a lot of ethical decisions. There are substances you can take that may not be on the banned list, but may be performance enhancing and give the athlete an unfair advantage. There's all sorts of, it's a minefield really. And, I want to go back, I think, in talking about this to 2010 and the end of the Team Sky's first year. I was working on a book that year that came out in 2011 called Sky's the Limit, and it really was a sort of covering Sky's first year in the sport and the beginning of their journey, their mission to try and win the Tour with a clean British rider. And it looked certainly at the end of 2010 as if that was pretty far-fetched, if not impossible. They had a very difficult first year. Bradley Wiggins, who'd finished fourth in the 2009 Tour, later upgraded to third, finished, I think, 24th in 2010, but he was well off the pace, and it didn't look like he was going to emerge as a Tour de France winner. At the end of 2010, I spoke to Dave Brailsford in the team bus at the Tour of Britain, and he was in a very reflective mood, and we had what, at the time, seemed to be a very interesting conversation, and perhaps even more so now. I asked him in particular because the question of being clean was really important at that time. You know, I think that the years leading up to the formation of Team Sky are very important context here as well. 2006, 7 and 8 in particular, when the sport was absolutely destroyed almost by a series of very serious doping scandals. There was a team that came along, Garmin Slipstream, in 2008 with anti-doping and really as its central ethos, its raison d'etre. And I think a lot of people wanted Team Sky to be similar, to have a similar, very strong anti-doping ethos. I don't think that anti-doping was Team Sky's raison d'etre. I think that as much as competing clean was important and central to what Dave Brailsford had always done with British cycling, I think with him, in contrast to Jonathan Vaughters at Garmin, winning was really important. And he sort of spoke about this when we chatted on the bus. He said, I asked him about, you know, how desperate are you to win? You know, what would you be prepared to do to win? And he said, the commitment to being clean, to using science and alternative methods and the best possible brains as an alternative to doping, that is imperative. It doesn't stop us wanting to perform. It is a clean team, but we can't say we'll be clean, but we won't bother about winning. I asked him how he ensured that the team was clean. He said they had lots of conversations about doping. It's not a taboo subject here. And we talk about the line. I asked him about the line because I was curious what he meant by that. He said, you know where the line is between what's allowed and what isn't. In cycling, it can sometimes be a bit blurred, but we will not go over it. That did sound a little bit ambiguous to me, and I spoke to the then Team Sky doctor, Richard Freeman, who said that he suspected there were still what he called dark practices going on in some other teams. I asked Brailsford then about that. He said, we need to have knowledge of what all the other riders and teams are doing in terms of performance enhancement, which doesn't necessarily mean doping, but that whole side of the sport is something, it's a topic that is ever present. He went on to say that he was convinced that a clean rider could win the Tour. You have to believe that it's possible to win the Tour clean. You have to. I believe the guys at that level are going right up to the line like everybody else. I certainly don't believe there's a clear, systematic doping program in the team which is allowing those guys to perform that well, but I certainly think they go right up to the line. And I suppose what, and when Brailsford was interviewed on Monday, he was asked a lot about the line and whether they had crossed the line in approving Wiggins' use of triamcinolone.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the obvious question in the cold light of Tuesday morning, a week after this all broke, is why is there any need to talk about the line, going up to the line, as though it's a continuum? I mean, in most people's minds, it's a clear-cut thing. You know, you're either clean or you're not. There shouldn't be kind of a spectrum of you know, slightly clean, a bit cleaner, or completely clean. And you know, we've spoken, we've already touched on sort of the founding principles and why the team was formed. You know, I think one reason why the team was formed was to engage as many people in Britain as possible, and to engage people in Britain on the basis that this was going to be different, and that they were going into professional cycling and they weren't going to succumb to some of the, you know, the dark practices that people had always associated with cycling, or certainly they had in the previous 15 years. And I suppose, unfortunately, whatever the motives and whatever kind of good or bad faith they brought into this decision, a lot of people feel now that this is not what they signed up for as fans, as spectators, as part of this journey. And, you know, you were there at the start, Rich, and I think you're probably aware of that as well. You can probably see that as well. And, you know, also just in terms of, well, Brailsford and what he wanted to do with the team and what he thought he was doing with the team. I think we've always had a feeling that he's certainly very focused on performance, and perhaps to the point where he's sometimes been blinkered about how things would look to the outside. And you know, this is a team that has really built its image on attention to detail. And right from the first training camp, I remember the blue Smarties that riders were given, or blue M&Ms, and you know, this was seen as a kind of microcosm of the attention they were going to bring to detail. And I think they've been slightly lacking in terms of knowing how things are going to look, and knowing, you know, like I said, what people's hopes were for this team and how it would look if they brought a Gert Landers in who was the, you know, the former Rabobank doctor, who about whom there were some fairly unsavoury revelations after he left Team Sky, and the same thing with Wiggins. You know, I mean, they applied for a TUE, which a specialist seems to have recommended, but the product itself, and I'm gonna call it Kennacorp because that's the commercial name by which it's usually referred to, and it's easy to say, frankly. You could go back 30 years, and that's always been, you know, it's well known as a product that's been abused. Going right back to the late 70s, Bernard Thévenet won 2 Tours de France and subsequently admitted that he'd used Kennacort, and he ended up in hospital because of it. And he'd abused it. That was different, you know, that was, well, there was no ambiguity there about whether it was therapeutic or not. But again, it's something that at the point where there was a debate, and Dave Brailsford has admitted that he was aware that Bradley Wiggins was going to get this TUE. You know, should they have known? Should they have known some of that context and understood it and thought, well, hang on, you know, it's a TUE. This is not going to get out into the public domain. But if it did, or just for our kind of for our consciences, is this something we should be doing? And I think, you know, the attention to detail again has been lacking on that front. If, and we assume that this was the case, if we take at face value their statements when the team was launched, if that is what they wanted to do, have a clean team.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, Daniel. I mean, if you think back to 2012 and the atmosphere that was around Bradley Wiggins and the questions that he faced almost daily at the Tour de France, are you a clean rider? Can you tell us you're winning this Tour de France clean? Had it been in the public domain then that Bradley Wiggins had taken a corticosteroid, admittedly within the rules and with permission from the anti-doping authorities and the UCI, and all the correct channels had been gone through, had that been in the public domain, that would have cast a very, very different complexion over the entire Tour de France. And in fact, if you think about any Tour de France winner or any contender in the Tour de France, if it was public knowledge that a drug as potent as this, or that people within cycling and experts say can have performance-enhancing benefits, was being used by a major contender, that would create huge controversy and questions. And the fact that it was done under a veil of anonymity and secretly, you know, doesn't really make it sit any easier at all, because the message that Team Sky and Dave Brailsford were projecting at the time was exactly that. We're going to win the Tour de France clean with a British rider. And then when you dig down into the detail, it really raises questions of what they consider clean to be. Is clean not taking medicine, or is clean taking medicine within rules, up to rules? I'm not going to say abusing the rules, but certainly exploiting rules that exist for very good reasons. Was this a good enough reason? And, you know, all the stuff that Bradley Wiggins and Dave Brailsford have said in recent days doesn't really quell those questions and that concern that this was a preventative or almost an insurance policy. It doesn't sit easily whatsoever.
One of the points that Brailsford made was valid, that you don't wait for an asthma attack before taking medication. So I think the preventative thing is valid. However, you know, there's prevention and there's prevention. It's like a small island having nuclear weapons or something. You know, there's appropriate prevention and there's inappropriate prevention. And what I guess we want to know is, how bad was Wiggins' condition? You know, what prompted the expert who examined him, who was Simon Hargreaves, an ear, nose and throat specialist, what was his rationale for prescribing and recommending this treatment? We would really like to know that. And there's a lot of debate and discussion around medical confidentiality and athletes, should they or should they not release their TUEs and medical records. Callum Skinner, the track cyclist, has today released as many of his medical records as he could find, going back to the age of 5, to prove that his asthma is legitimate, that he's been admitted to hospital on 4 occasions. That's very admirable. Not suggesting or saying every athlete should do the same, but in this case, I think we need to know. I haven't heard any sports doctors or people who've worked in cycling say that this was that they think this was an appropriate treatment?
Well, I think the timing of it is what leads people to that conclusion. I mean, Wiggins has had asthma. I mean, I've seen him with the blue puffer over the years, you know, the blue inhaler, which I think is salbutamol, or the Ventolin, I think is the trade name for that. That is permitted without a TUE and has been since 2010. That's a kind of a daily, you know, run-of-the-mill treatment, if I can call it that, for his asthma condition. He has hay fever issues as well, which could exacerbate asthma, so we are told. But the fact is that in June 2011, he won the Dauphiné. And then later that month, or very early in July, on the eve of the 2011 Tour de France, he had an injection of this corticosteroid. Same things happened to pretty much the same pattern in 2012, and then a third injection of it in 2013. The timing of the injections is what raises the big questions.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring the cycling podcast. There's lots of cycling still to come on Eurosport. Of course, the World Championships coming up pretty soon. But before that, on Saturday, 1st of October, Il Lombardia, live on Eurosport 1 from 1:30 till 4:15 p.m. in the UK. And coming up on Tuesday, on the 4th of October, from 2 till 4, is Banch, Shimi Banch on Eurosport 1 as well. That's live. So you raised some questions before we paused there, Lionel, and we're going to carry on talking about Bradley Wiggins and his TUEs, because it's an important subject that is that we can broaden out, you know, into a wider discussion about, you know, what is clean. And that is it, you know, you mentioned the line, and we do have to stress that Team Sky have not broken any rules. Bradley Wiggins is certainly not guilty of any kind of offence. They have operated within the rules. There's a wider discussion to be had, I mentioned, but also there's a focus here on the process of TUEs. And I think we understand that that's something that's tightening up all the time. There are certainly far fewer TUEs approved these days than there were a few years ago. I don't know if that's because fewer are being applied for, but across the whole sport, there were only 13 TUEs approved in 2015, which is a huge reduction on a few years ago.
One of the reasons for that, I gather, is that the rule change in 2010, or for the 2010 season, which meant that the salbutamol up to certain limits didn't need a TUE. Before that, just to use one of those inhalers would have required a TUE. So that's one of the reasons, I think, for the reduction. But still, it's a system that exists for legitimate reasons, Rich. You know, there are riders or athletes in any sport who may have medical conditions that need treatment, and the best treatment is something that is on the banned list. And there is a danger in reviewing all of this that the baby gets thrown out with the bathwater. But on the other hand, the system, you know, should it allow a drug that is, as Daniel says, historically associated with doping to be used legitimately with the filling in of some forms and, you know, a consultation with a doctor of your choosing, more or less. I mean,
well, we have to trust that I said this on Radio 5 Live last week, that we have to trust that process is rigorous and trustworthy. That's not to say that we do, or that we should at the moment, but we have to in order to trust clean sport.
Yeah, I mean, we have no other choice but to trust it. However, from our viewpoint now, it doesn't necessarily look all that rigorous. I mean, not being doctors, a process whereby a team or an athlete can choose a specialist, and we don't really know an awful lot about this specialist who examined Wiggins, and they can go off and they can get a diagnosis, and the athlete doesn't need to be examined by the person who, the doctor or anyone within the organisation that is granting effectively the certificate, seems a little bit, well, it seems to be, again, and this is these are terms that we used a few weeks ago when talking about Lizzie Armistead, there seems to be a lot of good faith or a degree of good faith involved, which I don't know, something that perhaps ought to be looked at. I mean, there are all sorts of questions I think the UCI have to ask. And well, we mustn't forget that they take their lead from WADA and the WADA code on these issues. But the issue of cortisone and corticoids, the MPCC have one set of rules which effectively or should prevent riders from abusing corticoids and using them to the end that we've heard something about, to lean up or lean out, to lose weight in between races. And this is, you know, an allegation or a suspicion that's been thrown at Wiggins and Team Sky now. Again, you know, at this stage, with the information we have, completely, well, unsubstantiated. And let's not forget the MPCC teams are, well, they hold themselves to different standards as far as corticoids are concerned. Well, it's very difficult for a rider who rides for an MPCC team to use corticoids out of competition. So that really takes away this hypothetical option of abusing a corticoid to performance enhancing ends.
Yeah, certainly, Daniel, you mentioned Sky and their position with the MPCC, which you should just say is the initial stand for the French, which is Mouvement Pour Cyclisme Crédible. Is that right? That would, so the movement for credible cycling. And this is a collection of teams who have agreed this rule that corticoids would not be used out of competition, and riders have been rested from races. I think Pierre Roland's probably the most famous or best known rider when he was riding for Europcar, was rested from racing.
George Bennett as well at one point, Lotto Jumbo NL rider, Lotto NL Jumbo rider.
Yeah, so and Dave Brailsford, although he didn't explicitly say it in our interview with him, he has definitely said, you know, off the record and in conversation, that he feels that Sky's policy is stricter and tighter than the MPCC, so why would they need to or want to be a part of that movement? And this whole issue kind of rides a coach and horses through that claim, really. You know, it's a nonsense, frankly.
Well, yeah, I think also there are personality issues at play here with Brailsford and some of the really key people at the MPCC. I think we can guess, imagine his relationship with Jonathan Vauters, who's been very vocal in his criticism of Team Sky and Bradley Wiggins over the last week, and has also come out with some quite interesting suggestions about TUEs and whether they should be public or not. I think there are serious personality issues. I think that those personality issues should be overcome or put to one side. Brailsford, I think when we spoke to him in 2014 about it, did make a good point about wanting rules to be universal and uniform rather than having some teams abiding by one set of rules and some teams abiding by a different set of rules. And I think there's also some validity in that. But I think that you know, Team Sky talk a lot about transparency. They get criticised for that a lot. I've always felt they've been pretty transparent. I've always been very prepared to give them the benefit of the doubt and really to defend them against rumour and innuendo. I've been very keen to stick to facts and evidence. But this goes beyond rumour and innuendo, doesn't it? And for many people, a line has been crossed. There seems to be a consensus of expert and medical opinion that the treatment applied for Wiggins was at best highly unusual and at worst dubious or suspicious. The only voices missing in this debate so far have been the medics who believe that it was appropriate treatment. So we're at the point now where it's not going to go away and people are entitled to be sceptical about the ethics of Team Sky.
Yeah, I quite agree, Rich, that we should be judging all of these cases on facts and evidence rather than rumour and innuendo, as you say. But it can't be overlooked that Team Sky and Dave Brailsford came in with some very strong statements, which, you know, netted them a lot of merit in certainly in PR terms. You know, the statement that they were going to win the Tour de France clean, coming off the back of an era where the 2006, 7 and 8 Tours de France had been completely overshadowed by doping scandals. The sport was in a hell of a mess at that time, and it was crying out for a team to come along with a strong, strident message to prove that winning could be achieved without doping, without medication. You know, these statements, no association with doping, zero tolerance, you know, have they really stood up to scrutiny right from the start? I mean, the first batch of staff that Team Sky hired included Sean Yates, Stephen de Jong and others who were, whether let go or however you want to describe it, after Wiggins' 2012 Tour de France victory and after the publication of the reasoned decision into Lance Armstrong and the way that the whole Lance Armstrong era blew open and had, you know, wide-reaching consequences for the sport and, you know, some of the consequences for Team Sky in that as well. And so, you know, over the lifespan of the team, there have been these issues which they have dealt with and moved on. And Dave Brailsford's point has always been, okay, yes, I would take your point, but we are not running a doping program in this team. You know, the hiring of Geert Leinders, who was a doctor with the Rabobank team in 2007 when Michael Rasmussen was within a few days of winning the Tour de France, but then was kicked out of the race while in the yellow jersey because it had emerged that he'd lied on his whereabouts information. You know, the hiring of Leinders was, you know, clearly a mistake. And now we are in a situation where it emerges that the first British Tour de France winner, you know, as I said earlier on, if the rule wasn't abused, it was certainly pushed right up to the line. And as I think you said earlier, Richard, the key point is to establish whether or not there was a genuine medical need for a drug of this nature before Tour de France and Giro d'Italia.
Ultimately, the only person who can tell us or explain why this drug was prescribed is the specialist who examined Wiggins, Simon Hargreaves, and the doctor at Team Sky, Richard Freeman, who applied for the TUE. These are the only people who can tell us the rationale behind that. Everybody else is speculating. Mm. All the other doctors out there are speculating. But having said that, you know, some people who I consider to be very fair and objective, somebody like Jeroen Swart, the South African sports scientist who oversaw Chris Froome's physiological tests a year ago, he's been very critical of the decision to use this particular product. And after Wiggins and Dave Brailsford said their piece, he said that in his opinion, it was either a very poor decision or a morally questionable one, and that we will never know. The problem for Brailsford and Wiggins is if it is one of those things, they cannot admit to either. To admit to either would be to put a stain against that 2012 to win, because it would be an admission of wrongdoing.
Just finally, Rich, just to try and be even-handed again about the substance used, I think it's natural that before a Grand Tour, and we're talking about Grand Tours, you know, there happens to be three Grand Tours before which Wiggins was prescribed the drug. It's natural when your body's about to be put through those rigors, and they're very important, and they're the main reason that the team has signed you and they're paying you a multi-million euro salary, that you will opt for the most aggressive treatment available and the treatment that gives you the best, the absolute best chance of not suffering, or makes you feel best, effectively. So I think, you know, that's perhaps understandable. On the other hand, the timing, the very specific timing of the prescriptions before those three Grand Tours doesn't look very good at all, does it? And particularly, you know, we're talking about pollen, or we're talking about allergies. I think it was a grass pollen allergy that was specified. The grass pollen season, as far as I know, does occur. It does coincide with the Tour de France. It doesn't coincide with the Giro d'Italia.
That's certainly worth saying, Daniel. Yeah. I think also, you know, he hadn't been on such strong medication before. He finished fourth in the Tour in 2009, upgraded to third on the medication that, you know, that he'd been using for years, as inhalers. Now, I would argue that was a harder Tour against a tougher field than the one that he won in 2012. That's maybe by the by. Conditions, medical, you know, your health, your allergies can change over time as well. They can develop, they can become more severe. I know that myself, that I developed allergies in my late 20s, early 30s that I'd never previously had. So it can change. And according to the specialist who examined Wiggins, he wasn't responding anymore in an optimal way to the medication that he'd been using. And that's why he went on to a stronger one. But as I say, it would be good to see some medical evidence of that experts can look at and say whether they agree or not.
And just as a footnote, Rich, it's interesting to note the number of, in particular, Grand Tour specialists and Grand Tour winners of late who have documented pollen allergies or asthma problems. Alberto Contador, he certainly talks about them in interviews. Nairo Quintana talks about them a lot at the Tour de France or after the Tour de France. And Chris Froome, of course, famously, well, he had an issue in 2014, Dauphiné, wasn't it? It was more of a chest infection, but he's also talked about asthma problems and used an inhaler. I think I'm right in saying.
Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world.
Thank you very much to Rafa for sponsoring the cycling podcast, as they've done since the start of the Tour de France and for the rest of this year. We're very grateful to them indeed for their sponsorship and their support of the cycling podcast. A bit of housekeeping. We released in our little break that we took after the Vuelta, we released our Alberto Contador special, El Pistolero, The Many Lives of Alberto Contador. That was released a couple of weeks ago for Friends of the Podcast, or last week, I think, for Friends of the Podcast. So thank you very much, everybody who has signed up as a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com, and many others who signed up last week on the release of the Contador special. Hope you enjoyed it. It's a bit of an epic, an hour and 45 minutes long. And it's got interviews with Michael Rasmussen, who's somebody who's weighed into the Bradley Wiggins debate, of course. And is actually at your back door there, Lionel, the chicken.
We do keep chickens. Neither
do you,
of them
call one of them Michael Rasmussen?
No, they're not called Michael Rasmussen. No.
Anyway, also, there's a very long interview that Daniel did with Johan Brunel, who obviously directed Alberto Contador to his two Tours of France. That's really fascinating, and some stuff in there that people will not have known about, I think. We also have interviews with Contador's mechanic, his brother Frank Contador, and longtime teammate and friend Jesus Hernandez, who's off to Trek Segafredo with him next year as Contador continues his career. So that's out. We also released the cycling podcast Femina last week, myself and Orla Shinawi, and that has a feature on Team Africa Rising, the women's team that's been set up in Africa, as well as an interview with Joanna Rousel-Shand. We've got Becky James, Katie Marchant, and a report from the final Women's World Tour race in Madrid. So that is available as well. Thank you very much to all who've listened to those podcasts. And another little thing I want to say before we carry on with our discussion and widen it out into the whole issue of TVs and medication, I suppose. And I'll read also a little statement that's been released today by Chris Froome. But we're really interested to hear what you, the listeners, think. A lot of you are big fans of Team Sky, we know that, and have an emotional investment in the team. What do you think about, we've heard a lot from experts, from critics, but what do fans think, or indeed non-fans of Team Sky? What's their position on the TUE case involving Bradley Wiggins? You know, how does it make them feel about the team? Has it lived up to the sort of expectations they have of it? Do you think that doing everything that you can within the rules is fine in the pursuit of winning? If you could send us in a clip of audio of just telling us, you know, what you think, does it, in your mind, affect the way you think about Bradley Wiggins' 2012 Tour de France win? That would be great. And we'll maybe play a selection of those next week. I think that would be really interesting to hear. So please send us in your audio to contact@thecyclingpodcast.com.
That's right, yeah. You can record it on your phone in a voice recorder app and then just email it to us, contact@thecyclingpodcast.com.
We should think of actually specific questions that they should perhaps answer in that audio to make it a little bit easier.
Well, I think people can say what they want. And
say what you want.
We'll play the cleanest legal ones that we can.
Yeah, say what you think. If you're upset, if you're not bothered, let us know. We want to know what you think. Well, I'll just read out this statement that Chris Froome has released this morning, which has been getting quite a lot of traction. Froome has put on social media the following: I take my position in the sport very seriously, and I know that I have to not only abide by the rules, but also go above and beyond that to set a good example, both morally and ethically. It is clear that the TUE system is open to abuse, and I believe that this is something that the UCI and WADA needs to urgently address. At the same time, there are athletes who not only abide by the rules that are in place, but also those of fair play. I have never had a win-at-all-costs approach in this regard. I am not looking to push the boundaries of the rules. I believe that this is something that athletes need to take responsibility for themselves until more stringent protocols can be put in place. Now, Froome, of course, has been at the centre of controversy himself about TUEs in 2014 when it became known publicly that he had applied for a TUE on the eve of the Tour Romandie, which he then won, and that sat very uncomfortably with a lot of people. I think there was a lot of negative publicity around that. The following year, 2015, he fell ill in the final week of the Tour de France when he was leading the race and didn't apply for TUE for medicine because he was aware and afraid, I suppose, of that coming out and it reflecting badly on him. His health was failing. His lead was crumbling. Nairo Quintana was getting closer. He didn't take the medication. I attended an event after that with him and David Walsh where they debated it, and Froome argued that he should have had the medication, and Walsh argued that he shouldn't have. And I kind of agree with Walsh. It's very, very difficult, this, because, you know, the Tour de France, a three-week Grand Tour, is a test of health and physical robustness, isn't it?
This is the problem in the era of heavy-duty blood doping, whether it be EPO or blood transfusions. The natural desire of the athlete to be as strong today as they were yesterday and to basically feel that they can compete at their best every day they get on the bike. And that is not really how the human body responds to endurance competition, is it? The idea of a race like the Tour de France or any endurance event is to break people down physically and mentally and see who is the best over the distance or the time that the competition lasts. And so the kind of desire of the athletes to maintain their maintain their level is what led to doping and then microdosing and basically topping up and making sure that they don't fall ill, that they don't experience any degeneration in their physical condition. And I think that this is part of a similar, taking it away a little bit from Bradley Wiggins' specific case, the desire of the athletes to be the best they can possibly be on every day that they compete. And that really isn't the point of the events that they're taking part in, is it? That's kind of fundamental and key to...
But it's perfectly understandable.
It's perfectly understandable.
It's refueling, warming down, everything is aimed to aid recovery.
Of course, yeah. And if you've spent a year preparing for the Tour de France and you get a common cold, that is, something that could derail your challenge. It's perfectly understandable that the riders would want to take whatever they can that is permitted within the rules or apply for a TUE if whatever they need is only admitted with permission. And so that's where we stray into this very complex debate and argument about the role of medicine in legitimate sporting competition.
Yeah, and I think we need to think about what sport is supposed to say, what is the purpose essentially of professional sport. The problem that professional cycling has, and this is why doping is such a huge issue in professional cycling, is that physiology and physical performance accounts for sort of 90-95% of the outcome, as opposed to football or darts, where there are other factors involved. You can talk about skill and so forth. It is undeniable that in professional cycling, someone's physical robustness, as you put it, Rich, and health is the predominant factor, and is the main reason why people watch. But if we're going to insist that we want the strongest guy to win, which most people do, let's face it, people get annoyed and angry when a rider crashes in the Tour de France and another guy wins because, he's not necessarily the strongest guy. So there is this clamour, this desire to see the strongest individual, the strongest physical specimen win. If it's essentially a health competition, then should we be giving people what are essentially artificial pharmaceutical aids to artificially elevate their health and, or as Bradley Wiggins put it, restore him to full health, when, this all seems fairly arbitrary. I mean, if someone is penalised by a natural handicap, i.e. asthma, how different is that from being penalised by a low hematocrit or just a tendency to produce a lot of lactic acid, which will inhibit performance. I mean, asthma is a performance inhibitor, but why is it that, you know, someone with a low red blood cell count is not allowed to take EPO, but someone with asthma is allowed to take a powerful
or low testosterone
corticosteroid? Yeah, and you do get into a lot of grey areas. I mean, I can understand on one hand, you know, an asthmatic who's not a professional cyclist saying, well, you know, if I'm allowed to take those substances and sit at home and you know, watch the Tour de France, why shouldn't a fellow asthmatic be allowed to compete while also doing that? But it gets very murky when, as we said from the outset, this drug is a drug with a long history.
Well, we haven't really said what the rumoured performance-enhancing benefits are. You know, and Brailsford and Wiggins sought to make a distinction between the legitimate medical use of it and the abuse of it. And, you know, we mentioned the chicken earlier, Michael Rasmussen, him, Jorgi Aksha, David Miller, are among those who've come out and said, oh, this was the most potent drug I used. They were also, of course, using EPO, testosterone, blood transfusions, maybe human growth hormone as well. You know, and there are agendas at play there as well, certainly. You know, some of these guys, a scandal like this, a case like this, a controversy like this, might mitigate some of their crimes, perhaps. That might be something worth bearing in mind when we read some of the comments. But it's not to dismiss them entirely. But what, as you understand it, Daniel, what are the rumoured performance enhancing benefits of triamcinolone?
Well, there are several that have been anecdotally reported. I mean, Dave Brailsford said in his interview with Dan Rohn at the BBC yesterday that he wasn't necessarily convinced of the performance enhancing capabilities of this substance. I think, I'm not suggesting that's disingenuous, but I think there's fairly good anecdotal evidence to suggest that they do help in various different ways. I mean, I was looking up a few interviews or memoirs of riders earlier today, and you know, there are all sorts of documented effects. It can induce a kind of euphoria. The CERC, or the Independent Commission Report in Cycling, which came out in 2015, didn't it? That talked about how teams had supposedly been using corticosteroids to lean up their riders and putting them on a course of corticosteroids, and they would lose weight and maintain muscle mass. You know, it has a kind of its main therapeutic use is as an anti-inflammatory, and of course this has implications for any kind of pain that one might experience when one is riding. So, you know, there are reasons why it's been very popular in professional cycling for, as I said, you know, the best part of 40 years.
But it can be used out of competition without a TUE.
It can.
I mean, that's the crazy aspect of this, isn't it? It's the timing of the TUE application, which on the one hand looks very bad. As I said, you know, why apply to use this drug just a handful of days before a Grand Tour? But on the other hand, if it was taken in a training block, then there wouldn't need to be a paper trail at all. It would just be taken. And that is, you know, that's one of the arguments of the MPCC, which is to have these voluntary rules that bar the use of these corticoids out of competition. So, you know, there's so many, you know, grey areas within the debate. But I do think that the fact that this is in the public domain now, you know, leads us on to, you know, a wider debate about, you know, the role of medicine within...
Well, the debate changes all the time. I mean, Daniel was talking there about, you know, topping up. There was a vogue in the 80s and the 90s for what a doctor called Francois Belloc, who was based in Bordeaux and treated Bernardino and Robert Miller, among others, he called hormone rebalancing, which was basically an excuse to top up people's levels of testosterone, which would become depleted over the course of a grand tour. Against the rules, so that's clearly crossing the line. But, you know, he believed that his job as a doctor was to keep athletes healthy, and that an athlete having being administered testosterone throughout a grand tour in small doses would end the race healthier. But that's, as Daniel said, the Tour de France is a test of an athlete's health and physique and capabilities over 3 weeks, not as though they're starting every day afresh. And so I think the debate and discussion around, you know, what is acceptable and what isn't is just changing and moving all the time, isn't it? I mean, you know, there are questions that have been posed by the leak of the TUEs that are now seem very obvious, or certainly are questions that will be asked as we move forward. But I remember in, you know, 2013, for some reason, the issue of TUEs was quite a big topic during that Tour de France. And we spoke to the then doctor at Team Sky, Alan Farrell, who gave us an interview about TUEs and about whether any riders at Team Sky were riding that year's tour with TUEs. They weren't. But, you know, had we done that interview the previous year with the Sky doctor at the time, it wasn't Alan Farrell then, you know, what would we have been told? Presumably we would have been told it's confidential, which is, and there are good reasons for that. It's very, very, it's a very complicated area, but there is a sort of clamour now for more information to be made public, for maybe for TUEs to be released. Jonathan Vaught has made the point that competing as a professional athlete is not a right, it's a privilege. And, you know, if you can't, if you're unwilling to disclose your application for TUEs, sadly, the door is closed.
Well, Jeroen Swart made a point which seems on the face of it to a layman like me a relatively sensible one. And I think Dave Brailsford echoed it in when he was saying, again, this just shows the thorny nature of the confidentiality. He said that Team Sky are revising their TUE policies and would look at possibly disclosing, or, you know, disclosing riders who are on TUEs with the rider's permission. So, I mean, that's not really disclosing the TUEs anyway. So, but your own Swartz point was that TUE could be anonymous if a rider is not competing, or an athlete is not competing. But if you want to enter the Tour de France with a TUE, then that has to be in the public domain. And, you know, even that is fraught with difficulty. But it does seem to be a step that would solve this controversy. You would be able to see who is on what medicine. But then that opens it up to public opinion as opposed to medical opinion. And that's where it gets very dangerous, because you could look at the list of the Tour de France top 10 and find that, say, three of them are on are riding with TUEs, permitting certain substances, without knowing exactly what those substances are and what the possible performance enhancing benefits might be, and the reasons why that substance is ordinarily banned. You would enter into an even more complicated area, and so in a way, sport is in a position, cycling particularly, where it's damned if it does and it's damned if it doesn't. And I can't at this particular moment see the clearest way forward. And that is the biggest challenge, not just for the UCI, but for WADA over the coming months.
And just to delve back into the specifics of this particular case, as a final point, the substance in question, Kennecourt Triamcinolone, it's been taken in this case with a TUE. There's widespread anecdotal reports, certainly from fairly well-respected figures in anti-doping and the medical community, that a rider wouldn't necessarily need a TUE to take this by injection in competition, because it's not difficult to detect, but WADA's thresholds, and it's a threshold test that it works by, are currently pretty generous, I understand. That it's a slow-release corticosteroid, and so only small amounts will show up in your urine at any given time. So it's possible that if Wiggins wanted to take this substance to cheat, he wouldn't have needed a TUE.
That's a very interesting point. I think it's worth trying to add a bit of perspective to it. There was a line that this might sound like putting a positive spin on it. It's not, or it's certainly not intended that way, but there was a good line or a good paragraph in Matt Dickinson's piece in the Times on, you know, following the Brailsford interview. He just pointed out Brailsford was not sitting yesterday at the centre of a major doping ring. That would be the greatest deception in the history of sport, and hypocrisy on a scale that would make Lance Armstrong blush. There is no evidence of that, far from it. We're not talking here about EPO and blood transfusions and human growth hormone and, you know, cocktails of banned drugs. And it shows perhaps how much the debate of discussion around anti-doping has actually moved on and progressed, that we are that a TUE for a product that might have been perfectly legitimately used has kicked up such a controversy. The scrutiny, the suspicion around elite sport has never been greater, but arguably it's never been harder to cheat. You know, if we're having this discussion, this lengthy conversation around an athlete using a substance that he's been cleared to use, it shows, does it not, that we have, that some progress has been made?
It's difficult to say whether that's definitely the case, but certainly this era of cycling is paying the price for previous generations and the drug scandals that blighted successive years, and of course the downfall of Lance Armstrong and the revelations of what happened during his time dominating the Tour de France. And I think that's really where Team Sky has misjudged not just its messages but its action, because as I said at the start, you know, that they banked a certain PR when they made these statements, you know, about winning the Tour with a clean British rider, and knowing that the public perception of that, you know, the average person watching the Tour de France isn't sort of caveating that by thinking, well, clean but for TUEs applied for to permit a corticosteroid, you know, a handful of days before the Tour de France. And I think that's why this story has blown up in quite the way that it has done.
I mean, communication's a problem as well. And I mentioned earlier the length of time it took for, you know, Wiggins and Brailsford to address the questions. Contrast that to Trek, who, when Fabian Cancellara was named in the Fancy Bears documents as having had corticosteroids, they released photographic evidence of him having had wasp stings, or, you know, where he was quite clearly affected. And that, you know, now, that was just a very effective way of dealing with the question. Not so easy in the case of Wiggins, perhaps. But as I've said repeatedly, I think we need a bit more reassurance that this was a legitimate product to use in the circumstances. And the only way to do that, and time to have done it, would have been last week. But the only way to really address this and really put people's minds at rest, or at least answer some of the questions, is to release some more documentation from the time that would answer some of these questions, perhaps. We should probably begin to wrap things up. I don't know if you've got anything else to add, Daniel.
No, Rich, I think we've exhausted the topic, and we're fairly exhausted by it ourselves.
We are exhausted by it. We haven't, as promised, talked about the Eneco Tour. It was a great race.
Well, maybe we'll catch up on that and the racing next week. But it's a matter of huge conflict, isn't it? On the one hand, no rules have been broken. On the other hand, it doesn't fit with Team Sky's stated, you know, aims at the outset, and it certainly doesn't fit with what people thought that 2012 Tour de France was all about. And that's where the big conflict is. Over the course of the week, I mean, I was on holiday when this broke, but I've been reading up on it, listening to all of the reaction and counter-reaction, and I flip-flopped from one way to the other, and I can see kind of all sides of it, and I can't, as I said, can't see a simple one-size-fits-all solution to this, because if you do away with the TUE system, then you penalise athletes unfairly in certain circumstances. If you make the TUE system public, then you could embarrass athletes in certain circumstances. But clearly the system does need tightening up, and the cycling particularly needs to offer a greater reassurance that there aren't loopholes that can be exploited for performance enhancing reasons.
Quite. I'm sure we'll return to it, if not next week, then at some point. As I said earlier, we're really, really interested and keen to hear what you think. Please send us in an audio clip with your reaction, and we'll play a selection of these next week. In the meantime, thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Lionel.
Thank you, Rich.